Spoken, mate.
I haven't thought about flying for a long time. I haven't dreamed of that moment when I was alone above the clouds for a long time. I have dreamed waking up in a room surrounded in blue and green grass for more years than I could dream of memory. I haven't walked back into the past or scratched on the doors of my origins, where it all came from, to hold up that cape for the last time.
Return to Kent Town 10th Year Anniversary Edition is a revised version of Andy Earn's first poetry book. The book can be purchased from Amazon and it contains numerous additional material.
Spoken Label.
Hi, it's Andy Earn from Spoken Label. Spoken Label was originally set up at the beginning of 2016 and records show it started off really as a one-off podcast chatting to writers, poets and artists. Over time, it became monthly, then weekly, and occasionally nowadays it goes on that to a more regular basis. To date, I've done over 330 sessions and I'm always looking for new poets, writers, artists, singer-songwriters, general interesting creative people to come onto the podcast. You can find this on all the usual networks over Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, Podbay, and dozens of others. But it does have a central database of Spoken Label, which is all one word, .bandcamp.com. Obviously now, to help me with the running costs of this podcast, I'm always grateful for any kind of donation to assist me with it. You can either do the donation through the Bandcamp page by putting in a fee to download one of the free podcasts, or send it over to my PayPal to aen1mpo@yahoo.co.uk. My email address again is aen1mpo@yahoo.co.uk. Enjoy the podcast. Take care. Bye.
Spoken Label.
Hey guys, Andy Earn, Spoken Label, back in the house Sunday evening. Yeah, it's not too bad today. It's a bit warmer than it has been anyway. So we're over to London today. Now, I've got a fantastic poet and writer with us today. I met this writer fairly recently over the internet through the stupendously brilliant and utterly bonkers Clive Osman. We've got the wonderful Namer with us today. Now, Namer, I think, first of all, we've got a lot of ground I want to talk to you about today. So, should we go right back to the beginning? Is that a good way of doing it? Because I know you told, I've read elsewhere that you started writing poetry as a child, didn't you?
Yes.
So tell us about that, first of all, then. I always love to hear writing about your children's poetry and stuff, if you remember it.
I've always been a bookworm, I suppose. I mean, I love the poetry of A.A. Milne, you know, with Christopher Robin.
Brilliant.
Hammers as well, and limericks and things like that. I enjoyed those that kind of literature as a child, and then, you know, it kind of inspired me to start writing my own. And I did used to write sort of funny limericks and short poems and short stories as well. And it was a great joy for me. My sister used to sort of set exercises for me, where she would she'd be doing her GCSE homework or something. She'd have a certain set of words and she'd give me some words and she'd say to me, why don't you see if you can work these into a poem? And then I would go off and I would have the task of doing that. And I loved it. I really enjoyed it. So from a very young age, I always wrote. And then through my teenage years, I kept a journal as well. So yeah, I think, you know, I've always enjoyed writing. It's been a nice little kind of haven for me, I think.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, really, because there's a lot of ground we're going to ask you next about it, but it's entirely up to you how you wanted to touch on this. But I know your first poetry book, which we'll talk about in a few moments, but I know it started obviously around about the time lockdown did, but I know you were working on a novel at that point, weren't you, as well?
Yes, I am. I'm still working on it.
Oh, you're still working on the novel now, then?
Yes, I still am. I experienced a terrible writer's block with the novel, and... I found that some of the poetry seemed to flow more easily for me. I suppose maybe with poetry, because certainly my own process is that the poem tends to lead me rather than I lead it. I may get the first line or the second line and then just kind of go where it goes. At that stage, I won't even know what themes I will be exploring in that piece. I will just sort of go with the flow. So that comes more naturally and it flows more naturally. And I suppose with a novel, you have to pay a lot of attention to detail, like dates and times and places and characters. It's a lot to, yeah.
Yeah, I've been done for that process myself because I bought up my first novel back end of last year. Yeah. And if people are wondering, the image at the back of it is the front cover of it. I like it. But that took me 12 and a half years to write. It's one of those ones where I was going backwards and forwards in it. And as I told you before, I'm dyspraxic. It took me probably twice as long as it should have done because I think I kept doubting myself at the time on it. And you do, you run into blocks in it sometimes, much easier than poetry sometimes. So, yeah, I agree. Now, people are wondering, obviously, your poetry book. If you're on video, you can see me doing this now because I've got the book here and I'm waving it in the air. COVID, the wordy wiles of a mind under lockdown. Now, I'm going to ask you first of all then, tell us about the title.
It was obviously during lockdown and I was locked in with two angsty teenagers. And I was also the main carer for my parents, who are quite elderly, so, and I had to be very careful about so I was super careful with who I mixed with, so it was a very isolated time. And I think during that time I mean, my father was diagnosed with dementia, which was quite a hard blow for us all. And then I think if that wasn't enough to contend with, I started menopause. So, God.
And two angry teenagers as well. Dear.
So it kind of felt like everything was coming at me at once. And sometimes it felt like, you know, when I was alone with my thoughts, it felt like all of these words and thoughts were coming at me at once. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of that story, Where the Wild Things Are, goes to the place where the wild things are. And it kind of felt like the mind was like that. There were a lot of like wild things all coming at you at once. And I thought, well, it's like the wordy wilds of a mind under lockdown.
Yeah. Now, I've seen elsewhere, and obviously this was the point when obviously like you decided to go back to your poetry itself. And did it feel weird stepping aside from doing it? Obviously, you're still forthcoming novel to go back to doing something you haven't tried for years.
It didn't feel weird because, you know what it was? As I said, I stopped writing when I got married, and I didn't write for a very long time, maybe probably 20-odd years. I mean, I didn't write. And then I started writing a little bit, but it wasn't necessarily poetry. It was more of like an advice column. I had a friend who had a show online and he started writing a little advice column for the show once a week, and I used to do that, so that was really kind of the start of writing. But I think with time it just felt like I naturally gravitated back to it, because I mean, I suppose for me, certainly the process of poetry itself is a very therapeutic one, in the sense that it allows you to make sense of your thoughts and, you know, sort of make peace with your demons, if you will.
Yeah, I think it does really. Like, it's certainly when I first started writing poetry, my proper adult stuff, when I hit 30, yeah, it was like I had a lot of things I needed to unpack in my head, really. And your book itself is definitely along those lines, but your background's fascinating, like I said, because I've seen a quote from you online, actually. Was it yesterday or today? Saying that it looks like you think you're probably the first British Moroccan poet, aren't you then, really? So it's all, and it's like, and your background and your work is absolute, it's very, very, very rich, it is. And that's, I think, it makes it such a fascinating book, this. Should we talk about a few of your poems in your book?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, like I said, people know I like doing little deep dives because I'm like that, but I'm not cruel. People wonder, I always ask the writer, obviously, so they know which ones. But
you're not going to go Jeremy Paxman on me.
Oh, God, I'm not. I am the anti-Jeremy Paxman. I'm hopeless I am sometimes. But, yeah. I want to talk about a couple of books. The book great itself. It's worth your time to track this out. But can you tell us, first of all, then, about No Filter? I'll take my notes, and we'll let you answer it then. But I think it's a great way of starting off the book, this. Because you've said to me already, like, this was the first poem you wrote, actually, for the book. And yes. I love the fact that I love that there's no filter with the aims of the book. And I think this sets it up really well. And I loved all the talk about social media in it. And I love the last line really got me, probably because I'm at that age. But I am old and the light in her eyes has died. That, to me, is such a damning indictment. I think you could argue with the younger generation is sometimes social media.
Yeah. I think, you know, I mean, that piece came out of lockdown and it came out of the madness on social media we saw during lockdown.
Because
it was so conflicted. I mean, you know, we had the rise of Trumpism and you know, and obviously our own god-awful Tory government as well. Yep. And, you know, it just felt like whenever you went on social media, it was just people constantly arguing and taking chunks out of each other or objectifying each other. And then sometimes, you know, you would get into a debate with somebody or something, and then they would turn around and they would say, oh, what would you know? You're just old. And you'd be like, okay, so right, so because I'm old, I'm invisible, my opinion is irrelevant, whatever, you understand. And, and I think so that's where the poem itself was birthed from that chaotic, sort of frenetic feeling of being online. And you do kind of feel kind of disattached from reality when you're there in that space.
Yeah, I agree with you completely with it. And it's a medium it's ironic we're doing a podcast here today. It's not something I am fully comfortable with to this day. Like, it's probably because I'm of the generation like you are. We can remember what life was like before that. And I tend to keep, I know Amanda White is saying, we try and keep a healthy distance from it. But it's easy to get pulled in sometimes, I think.
It's what makes me sad sometimes that, you know, sort of we've gotten to a stage where incapable of disagreeing with someone without being insulting or nasty about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's the other thing with social media is I've heard a theory said on this, and I'm not going to certainly not post this one online, but people can think about it themselves, is was social media created to divide society?
Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, I mean, social media certainly has its pros and cons, doesn't it? I mean, if we look at the poetic community, I mean, it's a wonderful tool.
Yeah, it's great for that.
Writers and poets from around the world.
Yeah, we try to be positive. Yes, I agree. And it's like it's helped me meet so many people from Spoken Label like yourself today as well. Yeah. And obviously, the stupendous and bonkers Clive Osmond as well, who I've picked up several times already today. But you're right, I do agree. Let's move on, okay? Before we turn into this debate about not poetry. But you are right indeed. Graduation, poem number two. I really liked the line in this piece, how far the apple falls, because it made me think of my own humble upbringing as a writer. And like I said, where I've gone to now. And I felt this poem was a journey piece for you, this was. And it was looking back at your life and also the graduation of, which I think was talking about one of your sons in this piece.
Yes, it is.
It's a fantastic piece.
My eldest son, I mean, he studied law at Cambridge, and, you know, for me, being somebody who had grown up, it's all, you know, poverty, I would say, yes, on a rundown council estate, who never actually made it to university because, you know, by the time I was 18, I was a mother, and then to see my son graduate from Cambridge, you know, it was a wonderful moment for me.
Yeah, people look at you from your social media things. There's a picture of you and him up from today from having lunch, and he's a fine looking man, he really is. And I know I've told you off mic already, I was shocked when you told me how old he was, and I thought, I didn't think you were old enough to have a son. That's why, but yeah, no, he's a fine looking man. So, okay, the third one I want to talk about is breaking. This is obviously something a bit different tone as well. Yeah, it made me think, because obviously, like I said, I don't know what you're like in this name, but I've not had a TV for over 7 or 8 years now because I don't like them particularly.
Yeah.
And my wife goes back even further in that. But like, it was over lockdown, certainly. We used to rely on the radio a lot more because my case would be, you know, you need to understand this, but that's your point, was the day job I was doing, they sent me home at the beginning of it. I'm diabetic, and said, go home, we'll get work to you in a week or two. 6 months later, they just got the work to me. So I was sat there, you know what I mean? Like, listening to the radio all day long, and because I couldn't leave the flat. It was just like, yeah. It was, and that's what I felt like. It nearly drove me crazy. And I think what you're about there, that felt like you must have been banging your head against the ceiling, basically, at that point, nearly, if I reckon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've had people talk to me about that piece of, like, it's Boris, isn't it? And I was like, yes, it is Boris.
Of course it's Boris. of course it's Boris.
You know, and it was, I think, you know, it was just like those briefings, those regular briefings that we had from the government. And then, you know, you would look outside and it felt like, you know, the whole world had been silenced. It was just, you know. It felt kind of surreal. And then there would be sort of announcing these numbers of how many people had unfortunately died. And then you think, and it was kind of likened to sort of times of the plague. And then I would imagine, you know, sort of in times of the plague, people brought out their dead. I mean, now we are in a different era where we just sort of announce statistics on the news.
It's still bad mind either way, but you know, I do agree with you with that. Love the line in it, and I know why you did this as well, because a car horn breaks the silence. Because it's like some of the other standards I've got, like you look at them on this one, there's a couple of lines per standard in most of these. That line, it's just a short statement, and I think it cruxes the poem really, really well there, it does. And it's like, did you think when you wrote that, put that line in, you must have put, what I know of you personally, you would have thought that through. But that line just makes, it underpins the poem in a real quite poignant way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I wanted to do with that was, you know, I wanted to kind of create that feeling of that surreal feeling of, you know, this can't be real. And then the kind of car horn kind of brings us back to reality.
Yeah. That's what I thought, yeah. It did. It was like everything else was almost like going on in your head inside the piece, or to a degree, or in the round you. But the car horn outside is suddenly how things, it changes the tempo. It's a fantastic piece, it really is. Last one I want to talk to you about is Sister. Yes. I know you've got us at least one sister already. Yes. So, but I love the image of Narnia in this. I think what you did in this really well, Naima, was, I think I've seen other people probably use Narnia in pieces and it doesn't work, because I think it's trying to get the balance here with the fantastical and the real and turn it to cliche. But I think this heightened things really well with different worlds not very far away from us. Tell us about where the idea for this piece came from.
Obviously, my sister, because I am very close to my sister. My parents worked a lot as children, and we were your typical latchkey kids, letting ourselves home. I mean, my sister was older than me, 3 years older than me, and I think she was kind of like a surrogate mother to me. You know, we were very close. She used to make me pancakes when I was upset, and she always used to read me bedtime stories. She introduced me to the Narnia Chronicles, and, you know, I was absolutely in love with them. You know, and she would always, you know, end the chapter on a cliffhanger, and I would be begging her to read more tomorrow. You know, and I think it was one of those memories that I've always held very dear. And I think I was just inspired in that moment.
Yeah, there's a love in this poem, there is. And the whole book works really well, because there's all kinds of conflicting emotions in this book for me. And I think not a lot of writers would have managed to tie that all together in the way you have. And that's very, very skillful writing, I personally believe, straight away. And that's why I love that poem. I want to talk about that one last, because I think it's a nice tenderness compared to some of the contrast of the madness going on in the rest of the book. It's not your fault. It's just life, isn't it? So,
yeah.
That's
that's why I had, you know, sort of some family pieces there to sort of kind of balance it. I mean, because when I spoke to my sons, I said to them, I'm so pleased that the editor liked each of the pieces I wrote about each one of my four sons. So he's decided to include them in the collection. So I was very pleased about that. And I was like, I'm going to let you guys guess who's who in the book. I'm sure you can tell.
I'm not going to give any further clues away there, right? So sometimes it's best to leave things ambiguous. I'm of the opinion anyway, straight away with it. Now, obviously, people wondering, obviously, a couple of years down the line now, and we're out of lockdown. So, and I know you've done doing quite a few readings, haven't you, as well?
Yes.
Post-lockdown, in person as well as on Zoom. So tell us about then how that's impacted your work, first of all, with this book, and obviously beyond that?
Well, beyond the book, I mean, it's certainly, no, I've had the, my work featured on BBC Radio quite several times, and on Wiltshire Radio. I mean, I've done a few podcasts in America, in Romania, in Lebanon, in the US. I've had several pieces published in different anthologies as well, and I performed at London Literary Festival Week at the South Bank Centre, and my work was included in the Women During Lockdown exhibition at the Houses of Common, which sort of kind of highlighted female voices during lockdown, and apparently is going to be included as part of the National Archive for COVID.
Great stuff is all I can say there. I've got no else to comment. So now, obviously, I'm going to look forward a bit more now. Just come and start slowly wrapping up now. I want to give you plenty of time to read a few pieces after the second half of this. Now, I know already there's a second collection, certainly on the way. That's on the final edit stage.
Yeah.
And this is, people wondering, you, as far as I'm aware, you've not got a publisher or release date for it yet. So no. Anybody's listening, get in contact. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic, right? So what hints can you give us about with the second collection?
Hints can I give? Oh, gosh.
Well, I know. Is that subtle reporting?
I suppose for me, my second collection is called Saging, Not Aging. And what it is, I suppose, because obviously my history with my cultural sort of background and being married, being a young mother and raising four sons. I think post 50, life started for me. A lot of doors opened for me where I was finally doing things that made me happy. And I wasn't taking a backseat as you do as a parent. So, it was the first time I got to sort of really work on myself. And I did, I was able to work on myself, but you know, I was also able to really enjoy life. I managed to survive menopause, and I've been able to travel, and I've had some wonderful experiences. Like I had an experience with a teacher who works in a school in the Sahara Desert, and he contacted
me. Wow.
And he had a class of English students, and he asked if I would give a talk on writing and poetry to his English students, and it was such a wonderful experience, because you know I looked into the classroom and it was like just this face of these children, and I was so pleased that so many of them were girls as well, and you know they just looked up at you like, oh, I said, I don't think they've ever seen a woman like me before in the Sahara, but they were engaged and they loved hearing about the journey, and they asked questions, and you know, and I really, really loved that experience. It really felt good to be able to encourage and inspire, especially more women in writing.
No, I agree with you completely. That's why mine's much more smaller than that, but the spoken label, I try to make sure I have at least as many, so as people aren't just straight, normal, white, cross males based. That's why you've got to, because the way society is developing, and I think lockdown, and I've read a quote from you somewhere, so if I agree with that, there's lots more female and non-binary writers coming out now than there is all the time in the last couple of years.
Absolutely.
And I think, with
Saging, Not Aging, I would say it explores themes of race, feminism, culture. And I think I do shine a light on maybe some hard-hitting things like child marriage and certain cultural practices like virginity testing and things like that. So I do tackle certain subjects in that collection.
Yeah, I think I'm looking forward to it, Josh. Yeah. Keep me informed when it's out, because I'm definitely going to get a copy. I was reading your first book, because the first book itself, you've asked a ton of difficult questions on it. And from what I know about you before meeting today, I knew there'd be other stuff you'd want to talk about in future collections as well. So definitely with that. Now, okay, let's look what's happening next for yourself, and apart from the book. Is there any sort of dates you've got coming up, like reading dates, anything you want to publicise to be?
I have, off the top of my head, I couldn't do. I know, I think on the 1st of March, I'm going to the Worcestershire Society. I'm performing there.
I think this is around about that point. This will be, so.
Yeah. So I think I have that in March. I mean, I am doing, with Ashley Edge, the upcoming event that Ashley Event has. I am doing that, and I am joining Clive for his one man show.
That's plenty to keep you going, isn't it, basically, at the moment, I would say. So, yeah, enjoy it. So, right, okay, let's have the plugs then, okay? Where can people get hold of your book, first of all?
Well, the book is available at most good online retailers, but, I mean, you can find it on Amazon, but if you are anti-Amazon, you can buy it directly from the publisher, Mica Press.
Fair enough. We'll put some links up for you on that one. Now, obviously, social media is for yourself, then. If people want to read up more about you, apart from obviously today, where do you recommend they go?
Well, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Insta, and I'm on Twitter.
The usual places, yeah.
Shamshoon or Naima Shamshoon, yeah.
Brilliant. I was going to ask you as well before we wrap up very quickly. Why did was there any direct plans with your book to call the first book as just your initial, then your surname?
I did. I think I kind of like the idea of the ambiguity of it.
Ah, fair enough. Yeah, I was just wondering then, second of all.
I thought about it, and then I thought, I kind of like the ambiguity. You know, is it written by a woman, a man, transgender? Who knows? But I kind of like that to have that little mysterious sort of thing. But obviously, as soon as you read the back cover, pretty much tells you all you need to know.
Ah, fair play. No, it's a great idea. So, anyway, wrap up part one for anyway. So we'll take a quick break, everybody. Hang around, because Neymar's going to do, I don't know what previous poems we discussed yet, but either way, that'll be fantastic. So thank you again, Neymar. We will see you all in two shakes from the dice.
Spoken Label.
Hey guys, Andy and Spoken Label, back in the house. I'm talking my hands tonight. Oh, anyway, back to my friend before, Neymar now, who's going to do, we've just agreed, four poems for their fantastic book. Over to you, my friend. Indeed. Take it away.
No filter. This is me. Here I sit, growing into my age jacket, accepting my invisibility, rebuking my fragility. Am I irrelevant? Wearing my wrinkles as a sackcloth and ashes. Should I reinvent myself for the applause of the social media masses? Twits, twittering on Twitter, showcasing shells on Insta, scrolling and trolling, perfecting personas on FB, photoshopping Melly, a veil of airbrushed sadness. I need more because I am less. Filtering faces, not words. Subsisting on praises. Captive in light cages. The eyes, that don't see me. The ears, that don't hear me. Should I put on my filter and dance to the hollow beat of a digital trance? A pound of flesh under the knife, erasing evidence of a lived life, fattening up my lips and arse. A fatted calf as a stranger berates me in the looking glass. Are my eyebrows on fleek? Am I scathingly savage enough? Am I too woke or not enough? I log in and await your critique. Let's celebrate the cover, not the book. Post the pic as the panel rates you. Have an opinion. We hate you. Immersing ourselves in the virtual brook. I have wandered the London streets, donning my expiry, as an invisibility cloak, as the gaze of the lit quickly retreats before dissolving into the city's big smoke. I have sat with Elliot as we shared despair, aftershock worn, shared niceties over tea and cakes and ices, exchanging troughs and peaks as we laughed and cried, bitching with Bukowski, waving to Sylvia as we died inside. Empty voices filling the space with speech, their flawless faces behind a screen. Me, out of touch. Them, out of reach. We're reality in the virtual scheme. I have haunted the void in between. Should I question the truth? As believing the lie, the horde flocked to TikTok, famous for 15 minutes, to shock, to rock, to mock, to exhibit without limit. But I am old, and the light in their eyes has died. Thank you.
No, I'm really glad you did that one today, because if people wonder, I never ask people, obviously, guests like Naomi today, what to do specific pieces, but I'm glad you did that. It was fantastic hearing that, because I've heard you do that one before, actually, but it's nice. It's a tremendous piece, it really, really is. We've discussed it in the first half, so I've got a lot else to say, but do you find that been... Because it's quite a lengthy piece anyway, people wondering with it. Whenever you do it live, does the way you project it change sometimes?
I think it does. I think, when I first started doing this, I think I hadn't kind of learned how to sort of bring more expression to the delivery. And I think sort of now, because I've performed it so many times, I've sort of learned to sort of add those little nuances, because it is kind of a sarcastically scathing piece. So I there are certain lines where you think you need to add that little bit of expression, so that is translated.
Yeah, no, it definitely does, and it works really, really, really well for that. I agree. So anyway, enough for me, more of you. I like that saying. I use that more than this podcast. So over to you, Naomi. Back for number two.
Look up in my book. Food bank. In the rooms where we make parcels, stacked up tins and non-perishables. When the virus has hit hard and morale is scarred, we struggle to hold all our marbles. Tailored bags, veggie or meat eater, selecting each item with loving care, feeding the families without a prayer. In the house of this stained glass-eyed preacher, my ties with Islamic culture cater to the tastes of the Ummah. In accordance with their sunnah, dignity beneath the vultures. Gluten-free treats for the children. A chocolate for mum to sweeten the glum. Community arms in the temple den. The excitement of something nice.
M&S biscuits, or a Waitrose dessert. The priceless pick-me-ups. We insert a leg up the human rights. Outside, the lofty rose window, a clattering of jackdaws noisily caws. Pre-made bundles conceal the storeroom floor. Misfortune offers no furlough. Protein for the meat eaters. Beef curry or steak and kidney pie. Taste the Orient with a chicken pad thai. Ignored by carnivorous leaders. A fairy cake home baking kit for quality time with the family. Amid poverty, making memories, the smell of baking, comforting the kids. Those already acquainted with nothing, and those who have lost it all, filing into the hallowed hall, the hurt, the broken cause, sometimes thankful, others biting, each of us one paycheck away from destitution. There, but for the grace of God, the God with the punishing rod. Party politics offers no divine restitution. Thank you.
Oh, now that's one because we haven't talked about in the first half, so I can ask more questions then. So, but again, yeah, it's, I think the food bank situation, I could go on a political rant on that, so we'll keep off that. But okay, what's the inspiration behind this piece then?
I mean, I volunteer at a local food bank, and obviously, I mean, I meet a lot of the people who come there, and you know, and I think, you know, people sometimes they assume that the only people who use food banks are people who are, you know, sort of very, really in the trenches of poverty, and it's or people who without skills or without, you know, any particular jobs, or the unemployed, if you will. You know, it's that kind of vilification. But, you know, the people that we see come through our doors are people from all walks of life. You have nurses, teachers, you know, single mothers, it's everything. And, you know, you see, and, you know, you engage with these people, and sometimes, you know, they just want somebody to speak to, and, you know, and you hear about their situation, and it's, you know, it is, I think that's really where the piece was inspired from.
Yeah, it's really vivid, really, really powerful piece, because I think the use of the food in it, it builds a detail up. I think when you're in a poem like this, what you're doing is you're showing, and definitely not telling, by using all mentions of the food that's in the actual food bank. I think it works really, really well. That was an excellent piece. Thank you for reading that. Okay, less of me, more of you.
On the grind, pressed in the threads of adulthood, forging the bonds that bind together in troubled times, when you can't see past the woods, harvesting and investing, delayed gratification, grafting out of your station, consume time without digesting, dreams of someday, get your foot on the property ladder, save on indulgences, and work harder, all work, no play. Put in the hours to rise, a promotion, a bonus for Jack, greasing the cogs to pick up the slack, strangled by the tie that ties. Grind your bones to make his bread. In a suit suited for ambition, silence, mental health's attrition. There is no success for the dead. Sacrifice for the future. Feather your pension to cushion the blow. Retire abroad in a rustic chateau. Eiderdown. For the new partner to shoulder the burden. A mortgage to swallow your labour. Life's force fueling the conveyor. Together picking out curtains. Thank you.
Stuff. Now, obviously, people want to go, this is the second poem in the book. I'm interested, obviously, would this actually been the second poem you wrote, or did you strategically place this poem in the book?
No, it wasn't the second one I placed. I think I actually wrote that piece much later. But I think my it was my publisher who actually sort of
decided the sequence. Yeah, it's an interesting choice in that second piece, because it's the tone of it, I think, is very, very different to the first poem indeed. It works really well, actually. I can see. I think it does flow on really well. So, but obviously, tell us about this poem then. On the grind, then.
Yeah.
What's the story behind this? I didn't say something else then, but yeah.
Yeah. I suppose it was one of those things that kind of addressed the work-life balance that we struggle to find in the Western world, I suppose, is that we seem to be feeding our physical strength into the system, and if you get a mortgage, and then that in itself feels like an enslavement for the next 20 odd years or something.
At least, yeah.
It just feels like you're always bound to something, always chasing after something.
Yeah, and I agree with you completely. I think it does. That's what I found about this piece. Yeah, when you played it, read it then, I thought, yeah, I can see that straight away. Great stuff.
And I saw it with my own children, young men sort of graduating from university, trying to find accommodation, trying to make their way in the world. And it is so, so, so difficult.
Yeah, I think the world is a different place, certainly when we both in our 20s, that's for sure of it. And by the time your children and my nephew, for example, get to our age, I think it's dare say the world will be completely different again.
Yeah, it's not as easy, I suppose, as when maybe you and I were in our 20s to be able to buy your own home.
Yeah,
you know, for most people, that's an unobtainable dream, certainly in London.
Oh, yeah. There's a point gone round, actually, by something I know that deals with a lot of people in London, where they say a lot of London now is not as many people actually work in the centre of London. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, I suppose like it seems to be changing, doesn't it, all the time?
It does. I mean, then, yeah, we have the huge wave of gentrification in a lot of areas as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, it seems the workplace balance around Manchester, where I am, for example, it seems to be a lot more where people actually now are still working like all kinds of hours. So it were more than previous lockdown. But a lot of it seems to be at home as well, where the balance seems to have changed in ways, half at home and half in the office, depending on the job you do. So, anyway. Yeah, I agree. On the grind, I think it's a great example of the changing movement of society. So, anyway, the big finale. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
One more time, then. Bless me. More of you.
Limbo. Africa falling. A convoy in the shadows. Constant and ever present. A home, but not a home. Anointing my edges. Still, I fit nowhere. Here, my name is foreign. My appearance questioned. Where are you from? Originally, probes Goldilocks. Cornfields in her hair. I have reconciled with the damp, dark streets, pierced by dimples of artificial light, illuminating an artificial pond. The dry wit and caustic humour, the sarcasm, the armour we wear, the sleazy sullied snickers of bawdry backstreet jokes, the women who reject gazing at the floor, audaciously holding his stare, the jangle of frenetic life, the busy life of others, filtering into our busy breaths, in the darkened alcoves and desolate cubicles of existence. Sartre echoed, "You are in bad company." The clattering coffee shops amid sips of acrid Arabica, the inane monologues on current affairs, clandestine consultations, a temporary respite, soaked in caffeine and butter pastries. London calling, cosmopolitan and enthralling. It is the home of a lodger, the key to the kingdom, presenting the illusion of belonging without belonging. The solitude as natural as blinking. There, my name is familiar, my appearance fusing with the dry alleyways and whitewashed facades, facing off a fierce sun in the hotchpotch pavement cafes where once Ginsberg and Jean Genet supped on mint tea, where tolerance is privately practiced, but never publicly preached. The lamb and inhuman infused air that coils and slithers for reclining across the skin like an impermeable veil. The language of my ancestors, tinged with my Britishness. My speech fluent, yet betraying, as wide-eyed locals chuckle like a pacifying parent. You're not from here, are you? In the Medinas, the night sky turns down the heat as families parade in their best attire. Sunflower seeds whose saltiness fizzes on the tongue. Sugar-roasted peanuts washed down with canary iced lemonade. The men who gawk belligerently, their eyes betraying the indignity of a shameless woman who refuses to look away. The crested clay tagines joyously bubbling away, enticing wisps of flavour, terracotta fat jolly uncles, the fragrance of l'enfance, the Gnawa drum beats, a throbbing pulse, dancing, chanting, healing, a portal to the beloved on the wings of a trance, a cultural hub that captivates and offends. a shared identity, an organic pond, rich with community, kindness, support, love. To serve is to be with Allah. The allotted roles, deeming marriage and its fruits, the paragon of ambition, gender hindered, scornful eyes from the arbiters of decency as I light my cigarette. I am without decency and without God, casting off the shackles of both, the dogma of belief or illusion, in the clutches of tradition, bleeding, bequeathed injury, spurred on by my scars. You're not from here, are you? The cross of the diaspora, life's longing for the other. Each suit offering some comfort, but ill-fitting nonetheless. Thank you.
Wow. I don't know what to say to that. My good God. It felt like that was almost like a novel, the chat was told in a poem then, if that makes sense. Because you covered so much ground in that. So I don't know where to unpack it, so but but it's like it was a life and showing snapshots of everybody else's lives. Was it quite a difficult poem to write that because of the length of it?
It was. It came to me very quickly. I think I wrote it maybe within a couple of days. I got like just the first line in my head, sort of Africa calling, and I kind of like that, and I kind of sort of went with it. And like I said, again, I didn't necessarily know which themes I would be exploring in that. I kind of just knew that it was going to be a cultural piece that kind of examined that duality of British and Moroccan, but also kind of shone maybe, you know, a light on certain, you know, cultural perceptions and ideas.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good idea to tell people with that, because all the first part was you touched so many lives around that. Like, it was it quite interesting? Did you find yourself when you finished it? Had you surprised yourself how much ground you'd actually covered of that piece?
I was, because I didn't expect it to be as long as it was. And it was like, you know, I'd write something and then I'd think, you know, okay, I think I'm done. And then I the next day I woke up and then more stuff started coming to me. And I thought, okay, right, this is going to be a longer piece than I'd intended. And I kind of just ran with it.
Yeah, no, it's tremendous. Absolutely. I was sat there absolutely spellbound of that. And I think, good God, I thought, I want to show you. It's one of those ones where, which I have seen done before, I had visions of them for a minute where it was going, you're going to read out the full of your second book then, actually done as one poem. Like, it's just true epic, incredible stuff. So, all right, we'll talk more of Mike anyway, but I want to thank you today, Nima. It's been absolute. I've looked forward to this since we booked this at the back end of the last year, so, and you haven't let me down in the slightest.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. It's been an absolute pleasure.
When book number two's out, let me know, okay? Because I want you one again, okay? I definitely want again. I want to see how the second book compares to the first book. I suspect it's going to be quite a different book, which is good, really. So, anyway, hang around, like I said. So we'll talk more for a minute or two. Okay, guys and girls, you can tell. Unfortunately, that's another episode. End the another episode for Spoken Lay. As Don Callis says, stay safe and stay over. And thank you again, Nima.
Thank you.
We will see you all next time.
Spoken Lay.